Keeping it real on CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
Sanbonani, I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is The Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Join me once again today is Kate Pater and Duncan Mabaso.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, everybody.
And joining us once again today is Lionel Makokotlela.
Hi, Gary. Thank you very much for having me again.
Yeah, we enjoyed you last week, so we've asked you to come back today.
Oh, definitely.
And maybe we'll keep you a little longer next time and the week after. We'll see how we go. Lionel, for those who didn't hear about you last week, you're a BCom law degree student. You have an MBA and a host of other degrees that we're not going to spend a half an hour talking about.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay, on today's show, well, even though social media is alight with racism, our guest today will demonstrate how South Africans of different ethnicity and social backgrounds can live and socialize side by side in integrated communities. Today is about real people of South Africa who see past the color and hatred of their neighbor. And today, the real people in studio are the ones that love their neighbor as they do themselves. So let's introduce these marvelous guests to you. Firstly, and in no particular order, the very compassionate and self-sacrificing Nigel Branken. Welcome to you, Nigel.
Thank you very much for the very kind introduction.
I think it's all true, I tell you, it's all true. Also with us, a man who's striving to prove that the world is wrong. He's a member of Mensa, M-E-N-S-A, not Mensa in Afrikaans people, and he's a Freistater. His name is Richard Shamali, and he's a legal strategist. And welcome to you, Richard.
Thanks, Gary.
Is the world right or wrong?
Oh, it's definitely wrong, but we'll set out to fix it.
Good. And we'll talk a little more about that later. Also joining us is Becky Dube, a man filled with curiosity, and he's described by his clients as a man with a brilliant vision. And that's all true as well. Welcome to you, Becky Dube.
Thank you, Gary.
Yeah. If you'd like to join with us today, our number is usual 0861-555-189, or you can Skype us on cliffcentral.com, or you can message us as usual, Kate.
Yeah, our Twitter handle is at Hertzlaw, H-E-R-T-Z-L-A-W.
Okay, let's talk firstly to the compassionate and self-sacrificing Nigel Branken.
Why marvelous intros today.
Nigel, let me just quickly introduce the facts. You are the head of a family. How many kids are there in the family?
We have six children.
Six marvelous children. You gave up your six-bedroom mid-rand home, your garden, your DSTV, your medical aid and your safety, and you moved into a high-rise block of flats in the center of Hillbrow. The question is, why?
I think for us, you know, we were looking at where South Africa was at. It was probably about 7 or 8 years ago, we started considering what were the massive challenges facing South Africa. For me, as I looked at South Africa then, the National Planning Commission report had just come out, and they talked about the two big challenges of poverty and inequality. Mm-hmm. But we began to look behind that. And for me, as I looked at South Africa and kind of said, what are the massive ideologies that are governing our society? For me, it was racism, consumerism, materialism, individualism, and greed. And I think that those, I don't think that's unique to South Africa, but those things have really gripped society. Mm. And as Christians, we felt that the best way to tackle these idols, ideologies, worldviews was to live in a counterculture way, to dream of a different world, what the world could look like if we lived differently. For us, as Christians, we think that making Christ king in our lives, I suppose, is about living out values which are different to the way that I suppose the world is trying to shape us. So to live counterculturally and to live, dreaming of a different world led us over, and 4 years ago we moved into Hillbrow. So we're confronting racism, if you like, by intentionally forming friendships with people who difference to us, but also trying to undo the structural legacy of racism and some of those things through intentional actions, through listening to our neighbors and then taking actions. And similarly with greed, through living simply or trying to adopt counterculture lifestyles to what we used to
be. We're going to take a lot down that very path. I just want to read something that I found quite frightening. It's a survey that was done by the Institute of Race Relations Now. They commissioned a national opinion survey of public attitudes to race, empowerment, and other policy issues. And this is what came out of it. Social media in particular has spoken of an unbridgeable gap that has developed between black and white South Africans. South Africans were said to have no interest in reconciliation, redress, and nation building. The white community was alleged to be racked with racism and filled with a deep desire to bring back apartheid. And black South Africans were said to be filled with hatred for whites and a strong desire for vengeance. Now, that's frightening. Mm. Is this a survey? Mm. Is this true?
I mean, I think that's, you know, I mean,
is this what we're living? Is this the society that we're living in?
Yeah. If I look at Joburg and my experience, I think the city is divided across race, national lines, across class lines, and those divisions are perpetuated or sustained in how we view others. And the less we have close relationships and close proximity to others, the more we hold values and beliefs that others are different and bad, and we hold stereotypes about others. But the closer we bring others to us, the more we can tackle those stereotypes. I think there's, I mean, obviously that's a survey, and the Institute for Race Relations has looked at this broadly. And certainly in my experience, I have friends who are across the spectrum. I have friends who
who's living next door to you.
Who's
living in across the passage, and who's living in your block of flats?
Yeah, I mean, in close proximity to us, Hillbrow is an interesting place. It's a very busy place. So you have this rhythm of life. People leave for work very early in the morning. You get people leaving from, 4 o'clock in the morning. People are beginning to catch taxis and leave and coming back very late at night. Mm-hmm. You have lots of people who are also there during the day. And then you've got a very vibrant business community on the streets and spilling out. So, to say who is living in Hillbrow, it's very diverse. You know, we have, in our block of flats, we have people who are domestic workers, maybe workers at cashiers at or waitresses and waiters. And
are they South Africans?
In Hillbrow, the stats are, I think it's about 77% foreigners, 55% Zimbabwean. In our block of flats particularly, we have a mix of mostly Zimbabweans and South Africans. Mm. So, yeah, there's... we are the only white family that we know.
In that block of flats.
In our block of flats. Yeah. But there's very few white South Africans living in Hillbrow.
Let's just talk to Lionel. Lionel, you have strong views on this.
No, certainly.
Especially on that survey that was done.
No, certainly. First and foremost, I just don't know the sample size of the stats that you just referred to. Because in some instances, some people tend to do their own research with trying to inflate fear in other people's lives. And what Nigel has actually experienced out there in the real world has been totally different. And one thing
I've just got to interrupt you on that. It said here, our field survey canvassed the views of a balanced sample of 2,245 people from all 9 provinces.
In relation to 53 million people in the country, that's like the drop in the ocean.
Yeah.
500,000 people that live in the 9 blocks.
Certainly. So we need to be quite careful when we quote stats. And what we ought to do as a society is to actually start speaking about our experiences, because it's through experiences that we become empowered. It's through experiences that we can actually try to really interact with other human beings, because stats on their own, they can really try to isolate people. Mm-hmm. So what I'm actually impressed with Nigel is the guts that he actually has taken by actually being the only white person in a block of flats where he's actually now living with other people from different cultures, different backgrounds. However, I just want to understand from Nigel's point of view as a Christian, because we know that there are different cultures that tends to be practiced, but then they're being seen as anti-religious. So how do you really marry the two, where people are still cultural and they still want to slaughter a goat or a chicken, and that might actually be not in the view of your religion? How do you create room for that?
Where is that a religion or a culture as well?
Some religion, they do slaughter goats and so forth for cleansing ceremonies. Mm. So when you marry the two, what has been your experience?
I haven't had any friends of mine or neighbors slaughtering goats in Hillbrow yet.
It's good news, though.
You would hope not.
That I'm aware
There's
of.
There's no one to pick it up in any case.
But, you know, I think people are different. Everybody's different to us, and everybody everybody's got a different worldview. Mm. And what's important, I think, is to get to know people and to get to understand them. And I think that, you know, regardless, to have fear of other people's beliefs distances us from them and prevents us from getting into genuine friendships. We can have dialogue about what I believe and what you believe. But actually, we're people and we need to get to know each other as people. And we find the things that are most important to people are things like family. Mm-hmm. It's providing for our family. There's common things to humanity that bring us together. Mm. And if we start relationships on the basis of what's different with us, we're going to find we're going to divide each other very easily. So the privileged position we are in Hillbrow is we're constantly confronted by people who are different to us. So we've had the privilege. I mean, one of my best friends is he's a rabbi and leads a synagogue in Parktown. I have friends who are Muslim. I have friends who are atheists. I have friends who perhaps don't have any religious beliefs, and I have friends who very strong in all sorts of different things. But the important thing is that we get together and we build friendships based on, hey, we're humans. And I'm not saying that we're not different, because we are different. But we've got to start with where our humanity is, and that can bring us together.
Wow.
Let's talk to our other guest, the man who's proving the world wrong. This is Richard Shamali. Richard, you're from a family, upper wealth, middle class family?
Yes, in Bloemfontein.
In Bloemfontein, okay. You're a law graduate, legal strategist. You presently work for ProBono.org.
That's correct.
You also got in, you did your articles with one of the big five. You must have passed with very high mark.
Yeah.
Cum laude or just about, whatever. Okay. Now, you could live anywhere.
Right.
Okay. You're 25 years old or?
Sure.
Yep. You've chosen to live in Hillbrow.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, when you first get that call that, you know, you've been accepted to the big five, obviously the thing is you move into Sandton, you make sure everyone knows about it, you put it on Facebook, and then you realize that, you know, after you have to spend the 2-hour prerequisite in the mirror before you can go to Sandton City, it's not really a lack of life to live.
Yeah. And did you groom your long beard? We'll tweet a picture of it.
I already did. No, I did not. I only started having my beard after going to Pro Bono. They're a lot more relaxed there.
Yeah.
But no, so the corporate atmosphere wasn't that great for me. I didn't enjoy living in Sandton. I didn't enjoy the pretense of it. And a friend had moved into Ponte, and I thought, well, here's an opportunity. This looks cool.
Yeah.
And I haven't looked back since.
How long have you been there?
Just over a year now.
Talk to us about your neighbors. Who lives next to you and who lives down the passage and so on?
Well, quite a few friends still. People have turned friends. I mean, my life, we've got a cool WhatsApp group amongst a couple of us that live on our floors.
Are these professional people?
Some are, some not. A lot of people in design, a couple of people who work as restaurateurs and so on.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and every couple of days someone will say, hey, just made a bunch of chicken soup. Pull in. So it's quite a lot of camaraderie that goes on there.
I drove past recently. There are a lot of broken windows. You know the broken window?
Sure.
Yeah. It needs a coat of paint. It doesn't look great. Forgive me. I hope I'm not offending too many people. But objectively, it just doesn't look too good. How's it inside?
On the inside, it looks a lot better than it does on the outside. I mean, each apartment is dealt with by whoever owns it. Yeah. So when you move in, they've sorted out, got brand new furnishings and everything. But obviously, for people who have been there for 2 or 3 years, you can't really control what they do. So after they leave, If the department's a mess, it will be a mess, but the people will come in and fix it before the next guys come in.
What about security? How do you get in and out of that building?
With a lot of difficulty, especially for guests. No, it's biometric fingerprints, and if I want to have guests over, if they have to stay over the night, then it's a bit tough because you have to get prearranged permission.
That can't be helping your dating life.
My dating life is fine. My sex life, not so much.
Touché. Yeah, well said, Kath. Yeah. So if a guest wants to sleep over, how does it work? You've got to get,
You get permission. Otherwise, they come in before 9 o'clock and they just stay on, and you have to pay a fine to get your ID back.
Oh, really?
How much is the fine?
$50.
That's fairly steep.
Yeah, well, it's cheaper than taking her to dinner, isn't it?
But I think women may actually object if they have to sign a permission form before they go on the date with you in case they're staying over the night.
What are you doing tonight, Kate?
I'm married. Sorry. 10 years. Very happy.
So Richard, you sign a lease before you move in. It states, most leases do that, only a certain number of people can reside in the flat.
Right.
In the apartment. Yeah. Do you recall yours? Or?
Yeah, it's a general principle of about 2 per bedroom. Yep. So I'm staying in a 2-bedroom, so it would be 4 people.
The people that live in Ponte, are they mainly South Africans or are they foreigners?
From my gauge of it, it would mostly be foreigners, but I haven't done a survey, and I doubt there is a survey.
Are there many people that have more than 4 people living in their apartments?
It would seem so, but a lot of them would be children, so I don't think children count.
Nigel, in your case, do they pack these apartments with people?
Yeah, so we also in our lease we've got a 2-bedroom apartment, and it had, before we moved in, had been converted into 5 rooms. Yeah. So, you know, lounges and stuff get converted into rooms, and and in our apartment there were 5 families staying in our apartment.
Yeah.
In our lease agreement, it says not more than 9 people.
Wow.
But again, we've been told 9 adults, you know, so children don't count. We pretty much almost at that limit with our number of kids. So, yeah, I'm glad it's just adults. We typically, and this is to deal with very, very steep rentals, you know, that are in the inner city. So we're paying for our apartment, we're paying almost 7,000 rand a month for this 2-bedroom in the center of Hillbrow.
That's a lot of money, isn't it?
No, it is.
Yeah, so that's very expensive.
No, it's quite expensive. And I, my experience in Pretoria has been that most people, they actually turn this into, like they would buy a lease and turn it into a business where they would rent out the other rooms and they would convert their dining room into a bedroom. And you'd find that there's a lot of overcrowding taking place because now people cannot really afford living into the inner city. And it's actually convenient for them to live in inner city because they work around and transport is accessible. So if then the landlords or the managing agent can actually take that into account, I think they would actually deal quite a lot with the overcrowding as well as the deteriorating of the buildings, because people cannot afford to pay the rates and taxes or the levies, for example.
There's a fantastic wall, you must have seen it. We call it the physical gum tree, where people paste loads of things that they're renting and selling. And you can literally rent space in a bed. You laugh. It's actually quite sad. But you can literally, because this is the struggle now.
You can rent a bed.
Yes. You can rent a bed. So how they work it is, say a security guard will go off on duty during the nighttime, and you can rent that 12 hours that he's on duty to stay in that bed.
Where is this wall?
See, I can't recall. It's in Hillbrow. You don't know what street
it's
name.
Called Community Wall. Yes. You find it also in Checkers and like your trees. They where they normally just clip the adverts and so forth. So that's basically a common trend that is actually also taking place in Pretoria, where people can actually just rent a bed for a particular hours or so.
It could be used for ulterior motives, couldn't it? People could be bringing.
Well, it depends.
Maybe instead of you paying the 50 rand, Richard, you bring your dates up to the spare bed.
There's a motel for that.
What about your kids are homeschooled, aren't they, Nigel Branken?
Well, we actually stopped homeschooling our kids after about a year of us moving in. So our children, we sent them to local schools.
Yeah.
And our oldest daughter's now gone off to Greenside, which is a little bit outside the area.
Local schools meaning what? The one in Hillbrow?
Well, Yeah, we started off at Joburg Girls Preparatory School, which is Joburg's oldest school, started in 1887.
So I think that's Bonato, right, the old Bonato.
So that's right on the border of Hillbrow, 1 kilometer from our house.
Yeah. How is the level there of education?
I think it's very good. I mean, it's a really good school.
Yeah.
There are also lots of schools in the area where there's a lot of challenges. You know, lots of kids. I mean, talk about education in the inner city as a whole. You could have a whole separate 10 discussions about that.
Yeah.
But, there's a lot of challenges around education in the inner city. There's not enough schools. Schools typically are very overcrowded. But Joburg Girls is quite a good school. Some of our kids are also going into Maboneng. So we've got 3 of our children at Spark Schools in Maboneng, which is absolutely an incredible school.
Mm-hmm.
They've also got a very exciting model. Give us
an idea of
what
kind of fees you pay there.
So it's at Joburg Girls, we're paying just on 500 rand a month, 600 rand a month.
Yeah.
And at Spark Schools in Maboneng, we're paying just on 1.5 per child per month.
You and I visited that school a couple of years ago.
Is that the one?
Yes. And it's where they've got all of the containers and they've changed the...
No, I don't think that's the one in Maboneng. No, I don't think that
one. Oh,
anyway,
it not
maybe
that
not.
One. Okay.
Yeah. What about, you see some horrific things in Hillbrow. I mean, I think I've read a report where you said you saw people injecting themselves with heroin, all kinds of horrible stuff. You live with that day to day, or is that...
Yeah,
what is going on in Hillbrow right now?
I think that, I mean, there is the reality that we have a very high drug problem in Hillbrow.
Mm.
You know, it's said that 20,000 people do heroin in Hillbrow every day. It's Nyayope, which is this horrible concoction drug, and it's very cheap and very accessible. So it's a very, and the reality is that also leads to crime in order for people to sustain that habit.
Mm-hmm.
For us, we felt that the way to deal with crime is to get to know community. You know, so we've intentionally gone on walks, bought apples at spaza shops, and then stopped at homeless people and shared an apple and talked a story.
Does everyone know you in the area?
I'm sure not everyone. There's quite a high population of Hillbrow, but certainly those people who are permanently there, we've got to know.
Mm.
So you'll find, in terms of the rhythms of the city, there's people moving in and out all the time.
Mm.
But at each corner, in each street, you'll find there's spaza shops, there's homeless people. Beggars typically in the city beg at the same corners, you know. It's very easy for people to start to blame beggars for crime. But you think, well, you know, if I beg at the same corner every or I'm washing a window at the same corner every single week after week, it's very unlikely that that person's the person who's committing the crime. It's generally the crime is committed by people coming into the area and going out the area.
Mm. So just before the show, I think Kate asked you a question about safety.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got beautiful young girls who are actually sitting
watching. Do you only have girls? Are they all girls? Or?
No, I've got 3 girls and 3 boys.
Oh, okay. Only the girls are here.
The girls came along today.
Yeah.
And I was just asking, I mean, you obviously are concerned for their safety.
Yeah, we talked through that quite a lot before we moved in. I think there's more fear of Hillbrow before you move in. So after you move in, you start to get into the rhythms. You start to learn, actually, this is community. We start to get to know people. You break down these barriers. And a lot of safety concerns are just perceived risks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we take precautions like anybody takes precautions. And I mean, there's never been any incident with any of our children.
Sure.
Feeling unsafe since we've been in Hillbrow. But they've led a very protected life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's just quite interesting that actually you can live in Hillbrow and there are people hiding behind huge walls.
Mm.
And that doesn't exempt them from being victims of crime. So, as you say, go into a community, know who your neighbors are, engage with people.
Mm.
And that's probably the best safety net versus security guards and electric fences.
Yeah, we, with these walks that we did, we started doing a thing on a Thursday night where we'd go and intentionally have meals with the homeless community. So we'd go and sit down and have meals. We didn't kind of do a soup kitchen story. We sat down and shared a meal and talked and told stories. We got our kids involved with that, a whole lot of friends, and that has just transformed our experience. So you walk down the streets in Hillbrow now, we know people who
you've broken bread with, literally.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, Richard makes a nice comment. I think it was on Facebook. He says, they always told me my head was in the clouds, hashtag Ponty Love. And he says he typed this on the way to work. Now, you walk from where to where?
from Ponte to Constitutional Hill.
And that's through Hillbrow.
That's directly
through
Hillbrow.
And you've also said there, I'm still alive, I have my phone, I have my money, I have my wallet. I mean, is it scary walking through Hillbrow?
I mean, the first time I tried it, the first time it is scary, but then you realize, you know, the people you're walking past are probably equally as scared of you as you would be walking, you know, through them before you tried it. Yeah. And, you know, it's cool. Like, you'd walk through, you'll buy an apple or a pear and some fruit, make dinner that night, and you get all your ingredients on the track home. And the more you engage with these people, as you say, the better it becomes. And I think, broadly speaking, it assists race relations as well, because here you've got, well, a white person speaking to a black person, buying from a black person, being reliant on them for their food source. And it creates this atmosphere of non-animosity, which is probably the type of thing that we should be creating as opposed to the animosity that we currently have.
Yeah. Do you speak Sotho?
I do. Yeah.
You come from that area?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you quite, well, fluent?
Bua se Sotho, yeah.
Okay.
Wow, I'm impressed.
Okay. Can you have a chat to the locals?
Just
the greeting and how things and
generally speaking, I don't try in case I say something wrong.
Yeah, you said something earlier, I think before the show, about talking to people in their own language.
Exactly. Yeah, I think if you really want to connect with people, it's best to communicate in their language because they're more likely to open up to you. And the same way, like I gave you the example of saying, if I came to you as a black person and I spoke to you in English and my accent was more polished, you're more likely to open up than somebody who didn't really speak the polished English. So in a way, language plays a critical ingredient in terms of connecting us to other people and also learning about their culture. Because if you are curious in terms of knowing why they do certain things the way they do and what you can actually learn from that, you realize that people are more willing to share the stories, share the experiences and everything else, so that we become a very integrated community.
Yeah, that's the voice of Lionel. There's a message here from Kodwa. He says, the problem has always been the white man's ego, him thinking he's superior even to a white woman. Is it a man or a woman?
It's a man.
Who wants to take that one?
I do.
Richard, yeah.
One must be mindful that you don't come off as an arrogant tosser, you know.
True.
You can speak the language, but you know, if you're doing it for pretense reasons or just to be like, look at what I can do. It comes across and it doesn't achieve the goal of, you know, bringing people together. Yeah. I mean, it's cool that you can speak a language, but don't abuse it. You know?
Yeah. True.
I think for me, there is a reality to that. Mm. We've grown up in South Africa. We've been trained in an incredibly oppressive system on how to be oppressors as white people. And we, to deconstruct that, is a process, and you know, people talk about we recovering racists, you know. The reality is that as white South Africans, there's a whole history, there's a whole way of thinking, and we've got and I think language is an incredibly important tool and we all white South Africans need to be able to speak an African or a South African language.
Are your kids learning at school Zulu?
Yeah, so I just have to say my three youngest.
I hope they're not learning Afrikaans, what do they learn then?
No, so our three youngest, I have to say, got distinctions in Zulu last year. Wow. So,
Let's bring them into studio. Are they outside?
No, they're not here, so unfortunately.
Just bring one up to the window there. Let's just talk to her.
That's an incredible story, I must say, Nigel, because I think the most important thing.
Come forward, Dolly.
Come, Rachie.
Come, Rach.
Rachel doesn't speak
Ninjani. Maybe she doesn't understand the English.
The three that speak Zulu are not here.
Okay.
We're also learning Zulu. There's some really great apps on that you can download and learn words every day. I can plug one called Memrise, which is really simple. You just go on and you learn five new words every day and just increase your vocabulary, speak to neighbors, speak to people who are different to you. Learning Zulu or learning Sotho or Xhosa, it's incredibly important, I think, for white South Africans to begin to learn other languages.
Nigel, we're going to break right now. There's something that you said that we're going to talk about after the break, and we're also going to introduce everyone to Becky Dube, There's something you said. You said if Jesus lived anywhere, it would be here, and you were referring to Heilbronn. It's quite an interesting statement. I know you're very Christian in your soul. We're going to talk about all that. Let's break for a moment. We'll be right back.
This is CliffCentral.com.
I patiently waited for you for 9 months. I would sit in my chair and talk about how I longed to meet you. I knew you'd be the most beautiful baby in the world. I was ready for you, but I wasn't ready for this. If you have a child in need of reconstructive surgery, Smile Foundation can help you. Visit www.smilefoundation.co.za or call us on 0861 276 453.
Choice. Sometimes you have it, and sometimes you don't. Auto Trader gives you the choice. Now you can shop, compare, and buy new cars. Watch our expert video reviews and research before you buy. Auto Trader New Car. The choice is yours.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
Ebony and ivory live together in perfect harmony, side by side on my piano keyboard. Oh Lord, why don't we?
Welcome back. Everyone, I'm Gary Hertzberg with Kate Pater again. Hi, Kate.
Hi, having very interesting conversations about Lionel, neighborhoods.
You too, Lionel.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gary. Very interesting topic, I must say.
Ebony and Ivory, Stevie Wonder, 1982, number one single. Do you remember the words to that one, Nigel? Yeah, indeed. Ebony and Ivory living together.
Don't want me to sing it. That's what.
Living together in perfect harmony. That's what our show's all about today. We're trying to demonstrate how South Africans of different ethnicity and social backgrounds can live and socialize side by side in an integrated community, which is exactly what all three of you are doing today. Let's bring in right now Becky Dube.
Yes.
Now, Becky, you fit in the following way. You run in Maboneng,
yes,
the backpackers,
yes,
called Curiosity. That's why I said very curious.
That's true.
Talk to us about who comes there and what's going on in Maboneng.
Yeah. So, yeah, we are based in the Maboneng precinct. And we're basically the first inner city backpackers in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
Really just aimed at making people engage with authentic Joburg. You know, immersing themselves with inner city Joburg and the surrounding communities itself. So we host about, on an average, I think close to 2,000 people a month.
Wow.
And 80% being international travelers, be it from Germany, Austria, Netherlands, and then 20% being domestic travelers. And we're trying to encourage more domestic travelers to really immerse themselves with experiences within the inner city.
Curiosity Backpackers is the name of your business.
That's
in Maboneng. The way to test whether a business is good or not is you go straight to TripAdvisor. And this is what they say about you. I didn't make it up. This is legit. They say, my experience at this hostel was so amazing that I don't even know where to begin. I guess I'll start with the staff. They're all sweet and so. They also made sure we knew where to party and actually came out with us. Very helpful.
This
is what they say about you. They say that I can't applaud this place enough. Becky is a rock star with a brilliant vision for the neighborhood. Congrats to you.
Thank
Lovely.
You.
And last one, we stayed over at Curiosity Backpackers for 2 nights. The atmosphere of the hostel was amazing. Now, what's going on? There's a lot of racial mingling and people are living side by side in Maboneng,
yeah,
which is downtown Joburg, isn't it?
No, that's true. I think really, I mean, the development of Maboneng has tried to create a space where, you know, people from all walks of life can interact, engage, yeah, leave work, play in an urban setting itself.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really great model on how African cities should be and how spaces can basically function properly and integrated within Africa itself.
You're the owner of the business?
Yes, I am.
Okay. The premises originally, it's at 302 Fox Street. Now, true. That's got its history.
True.
Quickly tell us what was there before you took it over and made it into a backpacker's
hospital. I mean, where Maboneng is in, it's in an area called City and Suburban, and that's where the first suburbs of Joburg started. And where we've set up Curiosity was formerly a 1949 printing house for a company called Pacific Press, who printed a lot of publications for the Black Sash movement, as well as a publication for the ANC, the Fighting Talk. So the likes of Nelson Mandela, Joe Slovo, Tokyo Sekhwale, we told that they would hide out on our mezzanine level.
Oh, okay.
So we've called our bar the Hideout to rewrite and retain the history of the space itself.
Yeah. If you haven't been down to the area, Maboneng, please go down there. It's worth looking at. Kate, you said something very interesting. You said there is mingling, but it's kind of on a
bit elitist. Yeah. Well, you know, it's hip. It's the place to be going. They've got fantastic kind of food markets and pubs and bars and all of that kind of stuff. But that comes with a cost. So it's excellent that we're moving towards something like this. But it does retain some elitism, purely just based on economics.
Yeah, yeah. I think in relation to other parts of Johannesburg, you know, which beat Sandton, Maboneng proves itself to be affordable. And in relation to the city, it might be a bit expensive. And as much as we, you know, basically the developers develop also high-end spaces, they've tried, you know, to accommodate low-cost income housing. And when you start speaking, I think, intensely with the developers, they see a multi-mixed-use development model as being the solution to merge the disparities that we have within our community. So there are spaces like Communality, Sandhill Flat, which cater, you know, for people who are low-income earners itself.
Yeah, hats off to you for having established what appears to be a very good business.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and to get international recognition like this on TripAdvisor is something.
And I think it's quite encouraging that people are now coming and actually doing inner city tours. So they're not just coming to South Africa for the Big Five and to go on safari. They're realizing that actually as a city or as an urban environment, we also have a lot to offer.
Completely.
Kudos to you.
Completely.
Yeah. Let's talk about your Christian faith, Nigel. The Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, which is what you quote. Yeah. And what really motivates you to do what you do. So you've given up a very comfortable lifestyle in the northern suburbs to move into Hillbrow, which we know is tough. I mean, it's a hard life there. Is this what's motivated you?
I think
Is this a place where, as you said, if Jesus lived anywhere, it would be here?
Yeah.
In Hillbrow?
I think Jesus was a radical. And he wasn't... you know, when I was looking at our Christianity probably 8-9 years ago, just looking at the journey we were at, we felt we were living a life that was completely irrelevant to where the country was at. It wasn't authentic. It wasn't addressing any of the real issues. And when I look at the way Jesus lived, I mean, he incarnated himself into, he was a refugee. Mm. He was actually a refugee in Africa, in Egypt, you know. He was homeless. He had the Bible says he had the Son of Man had no place to lay his head. There was something about Jesus that he was found amongst those who were poor and who were oppressed, and he demonstrated love. For me, the most powerful weapon we have to change the world is love. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's when we lay our lives down sacrificially that we're able to bring about transformation. I mean, having said all of this, I mean, we haven't gone into Hillbrow with the idea that we're these kind of saviors that are going to change the world. I think that we've come into Hillbrow to be neighbors, you know. So our mission statement has been, we want to become friends to our neighbors, and then we want to become good neighbors to our friends. And so the question we keep asking ourselves is, what does a good neighbor look like? And I think, for me, the kind of Christianity Jesus lived was this neighborliness. It was always people in front of him all the time that he was just touching, interacting, loving, respecting, honoring, giving dignity to. Mm-hmm. And that is at the heart of Christianity. So it's not about, you know, the Christianity I used to live was all about, how do we influence the world and how do we change the world and create a better place? But actually, the way we create a better world is by just at the very basic level, it's about going and being a neighbor. It's about going and and loving people and being genuine and forming equal relationships, equal friendships that aren't based on, hey, I'm privileged and I'm trying to help you out of your mess. Yeah. It's we neighbors.
You know, you've said something more beautiful than I could say it. You said, we are a rather ordinary family doing some extraordinary things. We believe as Christians that God is extremely concerned with the brokenness in our city and nation, and he's called each and every one of us to get involved in making a difference.
Yeah.
And you are making a difference. Wow, both of you. Very profound. It's beautiful. Yeah.
Very profound, I must say. I mean, this is just, it just takes me back to Mother Teresa, how Lady Diana lived her life in terms of actually just going to the ground level, interacting with people who are perceived in society as nobody. Sorry to utilize that word, but they really demonstrated something that really stayed with people for the rest of their lives. And when you respect, you value and appreciate a person, they're more likely to really connect with you at a deeper level. And bravo to you and your family for this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I think leadership, often, you know, there's this leadership vision, which is all about, you know, people to talk about leadership, and the vision of leadership is, I want to have lots of influence and I want to change, you know, I want to influence lots of people and I want to have power. But actually, I think when you look at the example of Jesus, leadership was about service. It was about, and it was about example. So if we're going to change the world, we have to vision what the world could look like, and we have to become, like Gandhi said, we have to become the change we want to see in the world. We have to have a vision for what that looks like. So for the vision I have for the world around me is one where race is not something that determines how you succeed. It's where there is enough for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. We need a society that, I mean, South Africa is just so divided economically. We are the third most unequal society in the world. This massive division, disparities economically. And the vision I have is one where people share their possessions. I'm not saying where there's complete equality. I'm talking about where there is enough for everyone, where everybody is treated with respect and dignity and kindness. If you dream of that world, then you need to create it around you.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why we moved into Hillbrow. We believe that people around us have got dignity. And we're living in the suburbs. You just don't get to interact with people at that level. You
know? We are the Freedom Charter of the ANC, and I paraphrase it. It says that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white, and that our country will never be prosperous or free until all our people live in brotherhood. Yeah. And that's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nelson Mandela also said, I've cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. Mm. Another person who's making a difference, Richard here sitting in studio, our Mensa member, could be anywhere. I mean, he could be with the top law firms. He could be earning mega bucks. Instead, he's chosen the path of helping others. What he now does is he works for probono.org. And this is really financially many, many steps down. But from your personal perspective, it's a million steps up. Talk to us, what is probono.org and how do you help everyone?
We facilitate legal services, and we're basically a clearinghouse. So what would happen is we gather people who require legal services, mostly indigent people, and we set them up with attorneys who are willing to help. We've noticed that a lot of attorneys who want to help tend not to have the capacity or time to go out and find people to help. Mm. So we facilitate that function. And then obviously we have in-house attorneys and me, the strategist, who deal with issues that don't need to go to attorneys. And there's an element of advocacy to it as well.
What kind of cases? I know you would be involved in some really big stuff where many people are involved, education, whatever. Give us some idea of what
we do. Mostly housing, refugee work, a lot of family law matters. We've started this awesome campaign. It's been running for 2 years, called the One Child a Year campaign. Where we help children in need. We find that, you know, even though the best interests of the child is enshrined in the Constitution and the Children's Act, and the High Court is the upper guardian of all children, it's impossible to access that justice because you don't have an attorney on your side as a child. Mm. So we do quite a lot of, it's actually quite sad that the state that some of these children are in, but getting them legal assistance is very personally edifying.
You also currently doing some diploma in financial planning or something? Yeah. Why the need for that? What do you,
Do you want the honest answer?
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah, I was in student leadership, so I flunked the final year of my LLB, and a few modules, and while I was repeating them, I didn't want to tell people I was repeating my year, so I just registered another degree over my BCom. And now I'm completing that. But it's pretty cool, like learning about economics and finance and stuff like that, to be able to assist people. It's different to see, like, the people I study with are focusing on one area of the economy, and here I am dealing with people who don't even have access to the economy. So it's interesting to see the vast differences in philosophy there.
What's the difference between probono.org and the Legal Aid Service?
Legal Aid mostly focuses on criminal work. So if, for example, children won't really get access to that because mostly they don't know about it, but there's not much criminal defense there. Sorry, I mean, Legal Aid does a lot of criminal defense.
Yeah.
If
a guy's been charged with whatever, he can apply for legal aid?
Correct.
No person in this country is not entitled to legal aid. Is that so?
That's so on paper, but you know, the quality of what you get there hangs in the balance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Say no more. Pro bono means what, Kate, as a lawyer?
Put me on the spot like that. It's free.
Yeah. Pro bono is free.
But the actual translation would be?
For the people.
For the people. For a friend or for the people.
For the people.
So if someone has a problem, do they walk into probono.org's offices? Or is it kind of a group that walks in, or what?
We see clients on an individual basis, and we prefer appointments. That way we can have a specialized person for...
If a person has a maintenance problem or that kind of stuff...
Yeah, we do a lot of
that. Oh, you do that?
Yeah, in a big way.
You're also helping other organizations as well, WITS Justice Project, people like that. Yeah.
We do a lot of advocacy, and we assist when there's public interest at hand. We do a lot of accreditation for public interest work on pro bono basis.
Yeah.
So NGOs that want their constitutions rewritten and things like that, we rock that.
Kate, you wanted to say something?
Yeah. Just that you also do sort of roadshows where you open it up and you get attorneys who come in and there's a hall full of people and people consult.
Well, we do clinics in various areas, and then we also do a lot of workshops. So for argument's sake, like, we'll have a children's workshop telling people, well, this is how to deal with children's issues.
Yeah.
Also, if there are attorneys in the house, you know, please come and register for us so we can send you some children that are in dire need of assistance.
Nigel Branken, who lives in Hillbrow. Nigel, how can we – you have a website called transforming.org.za.
That's right.
Okay, how can we volunteer, or anyone volunteer, and what are you looking for? What kind of help do you need?
Yeah, I mean, we think there's three different ways people can partner with us. I mean, obviously – I mean, we're Christians, so we'd love people to pray for us, and to, I think also we're looking for people who partner with us as volunteers. You can go onto our website and drop us an email if you want to volunteer. We have a range of projects. So we've got stuff that we're doing around, we've got a learning center for kids, we've got a soccer club, we do stuff in the parks, we involved with, on the streets with the homeless community. All sorts of different opportunities to get involved. And then also financially, people can contribute as well. And there's links on the website if people want to make any contributions there.
Cool. I don't know whether this is tongue-in-cheek or not. We have a message here. Even if aliens landed on Earth, then white people would choose them aliens over us.
I disagree. Depends. Come on. Like, let's just be quite honest about this. It depends. You choose who you want to connect with, and as our guests have demonstrated today, they've decided to connect with people at the lower level. Mm-hmm. And most of us, black people as well, we try to disconnect from people who are at the lower level where we can uplift our community. So at the end of the day, I think it's a conversation that we need to start having with ourselves and start looking at things holistically and not be narrow-minded in terms of trying to slur insults to other people who are actually trying to do something for the communities.
Yeah.
That's just the reality. I really don't agree with the statement. I'm sorry.
I think South Africans have got to engage. We've got to engage. Yes. And we've stopped engaging. I think over the last sort of 5-10 years, the kind of social cohesion projects that we've been doing before, we've lost that, you know, and we need to get back into forming friendships with people who are different to us. And those
what's going wrong with us South Africans? Why are we falling apart? Anyone want to take that
one? I think really what's going on is that collectively we all seem to feel I don't know, entitled to mudsling, and then people can connect on an individual basis. And I think if we carry on focusing on that, people are very seldom will you encounter somebody who will scream in your face or give you a racial slur directly. So we're talking as collectives and us's and them's and all of that kind of thing. Whereas if you walk out on the street and you say hello to somebody, there doesn't seem to be that level of animosity.
When we sit together, there's no animosity. It's messages that are coming in like this that we've just read out.
I mean, this is inflammatory. He's trying to elicit a response.
I don't know what he's after, but anyway, yeah, you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I think as a society, as a community, if you really want to propel ourselves to the next level, we need to bring about everything to the table of knowledge, be it African philosophy, be it Western philosophy. Then we can really understand who we are, where we come from, and how we view things. And that way we can really open ourselves up and start really accommodating other people's philosophies, which might also be adding value to our own philosophies. So at the end of the day, if we are now going to be trying to distinguish ourselves based on our skin color, and based on my blackness and your whiteness, we really are not going to go anywhere. I think we need demonstrators like the Nigels of this world who can go into a community and connect with people at the core of their being, as opposed to just their skin color.
But I think there's something to advance on that. I mean, it's easy to just dismiss the claim as inflammatory. But what we often miss as South Africans in this debate is something must have provoked that in his or her lived reality. And as Nigel correctly puts, like, you're not going to change the world, but you can change the world of very few people.
Yeah.
And in engaging with this person and saying, you know, why do you see this? Like, here I am as a white guy. I'm trying to live amongst you. What is the issue? Why do you feel this way collectively about white people? Then, you know, we can have that conversation, but allowing those feelings to fester and having them undisputed or unengaged with, I think that's a huge problem and something we seem to do a lot of in South Africa.
Does a white man have an ego historically? Is this one of the problems? Historically, that white men have an ego?
I would think so,
I also think so, because, I mean, if we go into the table of knowledge, African philosophies and African teachings have actually been regarded as either not so contributing to our lives. But at the end of the day, if you really go to the core of our being, Africans have always been a we community, where we connect as a community as opposed to I. So at the end of the day, we need to start going back to those roots and really bring the African philosophies to the table of knowledge so that we can talk about it openly and really tend to understand why people behave in a certain way or why do people feel offended when certain things are being done. Mm. For example, there was also another painting where a particular public figure was actually drawn with the private parts for people to see. So that on its own, from a cultural point of view, to me, it felt like this is just like pushing it, because in our culture, you cannot really be depicting people in that manner. And at the end of the day, other people might say this is freedom of speech. So how do we bring balance in terms of the freedom of speech, cultures, and marrying everything together so that we can live in harmony?
Yeah, we have a very smart listener here. He says that I have one word for you. And I was scared to look. I thought he was going to tell me to. He says it's Oranje.
Oranje, sure.
Oranje. We all know about Oranje. That's where Afrikaans people live in isolation.
Sad, eh?
Yeah.
Are we actually?
And he's quite right. I mean,
we were on holiday this year. We went. We did a road trip, and we went past via Kimberley, and we passed the petrol station, which was We actually, our car broke down and we needed some accommodation. So the guy said to me, well, if you just go down the road, Oranje's there and it's very good accommodation. And I said, Oranje, I was like freaking out. But I ended up chatting to the petrol attendant there and just listening to some of his perspectives about that. I mean, it's not a place that's the kind of world. It just talked about the fear that the community around it experienced from that there's a lot of violence against those around. It's to go and separate ourselves as communities is just such a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, going back to your previous
about
the aliens, and I think we have to acknowledge the reality that there is a lot of pain in this country. Mm-hmm. And And much of, you know, I was recently on Robben Island with, and Desmond Tutu's just brought out a book called There's No Future Without Forgiveness.
Yeah.
And we were reflecting on this theme of forgiveness. And I think 94, a lot of the stuff was around, hey, we're going to forgive and we're going to move on. But we didn't really deal with the issues of the gross inequalities that are existing in our society. And I think there's a lot of stuff that still needs to be done about the injustices that exist and the gross disparities that exist between races economically. So when you live where I live, you see the world differently. You see all the injustice. I mean, it's horrific. The first year we moved into Hillbrow, we had five friends who had babies and four of their babies died. And
hospital.
Yeah, ambulances arriving late, people getting turned away from hospital, you know, all sorts of prejudice that exists against those who are poor and marginalized. Mm. It's very difficult. I'm sure Richard's got lots of stories of those kinds of things where people are constantly being further excluded from society. Mm. And we've got to deal with that pain. We've got to, you know, the reality is, as white South Africans, we've been involved in a system of white supremacy that has oppressed many South Africans. And we've got to acknowledge that into our relationships. We've got to find ways to undo that.
There's a show that I'm dying to run. It's about the Afrikaners who now live in white squatter camps. According to reports, it may be disputed, but the numbers are believed to be about 400,000 Afrikaners who live in white squatter camps throughout the country. Do you know anything about that?
Well, Africa Check has, in fact, fact-checked that, and it's not quite an accurate statistic.
Isn't it? Yeah. So what is this?
I can't remember. I just remembered reading the headlines on Africa Check saying that this is a false claim.
Okay.
I mean, I think certainly the reality is there are white South Africans who are struggling in poverty, but we can't say that being white in South Africa means that we don't have privilege, you know. We come from a system of privilege. Being privileged means that we have advantage that people from other race groups don't have.
Before we let you go, Richard, member of Mensa, anything you want to add?
Gorgeous, kind,
and clever. I mean, you've pretty much got it done.
I like that, Richard.
You're married, don't forget that.
So, Richard, if you don't want to pay the 50 rand to let a girl into your place, you can go to Curiosity in Maboneng. What are your rates there? Will you give Richard a special?
We'll give you a discount.
49.99. It's been a fantastic show, and with marvelous, absolutely phenomenal guests. Lionel, yeah.
Thank you so very much. No, this was very interesting, Gary. I think we really need to have more of this kind of talks so that we can just really connect with people at the core of their being.
Cool. Yeah. I'd like to thank Becky Dube. Are you so famous, Dube? Are you related to...
I wish. Okay. Yeah. Too lucky. No, I wish.
Well, maybe not. You would have had a dead daddy as such.
Completely.
Okay, good luck with Curiosity Backpackers in Maboneng.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to come down there and get a drink. What's the bar called?
Hideout.
Yeah. To the Branken family, courageous, determined, marvelous, terrific.
Thank you so
much. Keep going. I wish we could. We're going to come back to you and find out in a few months' time how things are and what the news is.
Wonderful. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Also to Richard Shamali, a well-known Lebanese name, I think, Shamalis. Yeah.
Sorry, can I just step in? Sure, I'll be fired from my awesome job if I don't plug.
Please do, pro bono.
Yeah, if you need legal assistance in housing, family law, or anything, come give us a call.
Cool. If you've had a personal experience that you'd like to share with us,
you can email, comments, anything. Suggestions for future shows, it's law@cliffcentral.com.
To my researcher, Brigitte Meyer, thank you for putting the show together. Lastly, I think, Nigel, you mentioned this earlier, and this is what Gandhi said, be the change that you wish to see in the world. Love that one. On that note, thanks for listening, and until next Tuesday at 12 noon, I'm Gary Hertzberg.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on cliffcentral.com.